I will call to order as a subcommittee the Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Today is Tuesday, September 17th, 2013. We're convened for a series of informational meetings and hearings, and we will also adopt rules as soon as we get a quorum. But before we have a quorum, I'd like to go ahead and be respectful of everyone's time and dive into the first agenda item, which is an update on Senate Bill 558 and other foreclosure avoidance programs. Chan, is there anything you would like to tee up for us?
Chair Shields, I think you've hit the general overview there.
Okay. Why don't we bring up Janet Borth, Margaret Van Vliet, and Emily Ryman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and get started. Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And I'm here to provide a little bit of context from the perspective of the Housing and Community Services Department about the foreclosure issues. But mostly you're going to hear from my colleagues today. We're going to try and use this fancy clicker. And look, it worked. So the context for this work in a changing sort of environment is that there are some signs that the housing market is beginning to recover, but we do know that lots of homeowners continue to be in distress and at risk of not being able to make their mortgage payments. So this slide really talks about the trends over time in delinquencies, a 90-day delinquency, I think you know, is a trigger point, a data point that we look at to sort of measure how many folks are potentially at risk of having their home foreclosed upon. And that number continues to be hovering right around 30,000 homeowners in Oregon. And so that's an important data point we want to keep an eye on. I think you also recall that about 3 years ago, Oregon was designated a hardest hit state by the federal government, U.S. Department of Treasury. The bad news about that was that our employment and foreclosure rates were high, and the good news was we did get some additional funds from the U.S. Department of Treasury, and I'll talk about that in a minute. These are tools and programs that you have some familiarity with, but just to sort of reacquaint you with sort of what how this conversation has progressed in Oregon. For several years, we'd had a network of housing counselors out in communities in Oregon. They, of course, started their work as homeowner education counselors, and as the recession hit and foreclosures became a big threat, many of them also took up the issue of foreclosure avoidance counseling. And so we have a strong network, and more are doing foreclosure mitigation counseling. And Emily Ryman will talk to you about that in a couple of minutes. As I mentioned, in 2010, Oregon received an allocation of $220 million of hardest hit funds. This is actually TARP money, or Troubled Assets Relief Program money, that came to the state to deal with the foreclosure crisis. It took us some time as a state agency to begin to get those dollars out the door, but I'm happy to report that they are almost all spoken for, and that program is proceeding well. We've now served over 8,000 homeowners in Oregon with that resource. You will also recall, of course, the multi-state settlement that that the state's attorneys generals worked out with five national banks, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And the Oregon legislature, of course, introduced the tools around mediation, and I think that's what you want to talk more about today. Just a quick word about how the multi-state settlement fits into this picture. It's a complicated picture, but the effectively 29 million came into the general fund for discretionary purposes. You appropriated 8 million, a little over 8 million, in two sessions to my agency, and an additional sum to the Department of Justice to put in place some new programs and to support the new mediation law. And so the work that my agency has done in this context is a contract with local nonprofits to do the foreclosure counseling piece, and we've done that over the past couple of years, and that's where the bulk of the funds have been invested. We've also spent money to provide legal assistance through the Oregon Legal Aid Services to help homeowners who need a little more help than a counselor might be able to provide as they're thinking about mediation and talking to banks. And then you also invested in work that our agency has led, but done very much in partnership around outreach to make sure homeowners knew what they were eligible for. And so then there's these other pieces that went to Department of Justice, and you can hear about those in a minute. So within my agency, again, we've done these three primary activities, all through local partnerships. We don't have counselors on the payroll. It's the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. We've contracted through nonprofits. You'll hear from one in a minute. And we've tried to do this in a way that supports the mediation legislation and the bigger context of the work that's happening around foreclosure. What we know is it's a very confusing world. It's confusing to those of us in state government. It's really confusing to consumers and homeowners. So part of the outreach has been to really make it accessible and provide tools online and in communities in accessible storefronts so folks know how to get help if they feel like they're at risk of losing their home. So I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Janet, who will go a little deeper into some of the mediation and related work.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I've been working pretty extensively with the implementation of the mediation program. Just to briefly recap, 1552 that was passed back in 2012, at the time required mediation only in non-judicial foreclosures, which was the predominant method of foreclosure at the time. But the Nite A decision came down right about the same time that 1552 went into effect, and so we did not see a lot of participation in the program. What we can say that was promising is that of the cases that did go to mediation, they had pretty good results, and over half settled at mediation, several settled after mediation, and several other cases actually settled before going to mediation. Here's a little bit of a bigger picture of what's been happening to foreclosures in Oregon. We can see the spike in foreclosures, and foreclosures went down a little bit in 2012. That's largely in the last part of 2012. We saw a real drop-off in foreclosures as industry reacted to Nite A and possibly to some extent 1552, and we are seeing the total foreclosures go up in 2013. I'll just note that 2012 and 2013, these aren't official numbers just yet, but they should be fairly close, and you can see that that yellow judicial foreclosure line is going up while the blue line is going down for non-judicial foreclosures. Which brings us to Senate Bill 558. It closed that judicial foreclosure.
I just need you to just quickly remind me the difference between judicial and non-judicial foreclosure.
Chair Shields, Senator Manus Anderson, a non-judicial foreclosure is a foreclosure that happens outside of the court system through the recording process with the county clerks, and a judicial foreclosure involves a lawsuit. They're just two different methods.
So judicial really is going up? I hate to see that.
Chair Shields, Senator Manus Anderson, I think there are a few reasons that judicial foreclosure has gone up, and one of them is a pretty technical one, where one of the requirements of a non-judicial foreclosure, there's a recording requirement that a court decision that came out called Nite A right in the summer of 2012 brought into question whether that was a method that some of the larger banks could use for foreclosure, and that technical requirement is not in the judicial realm.
Let me ask you a question. So we had the Supreme Court settle Nite A at the end of last session. Have you seen any differences since the Supreme Court's ruling?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I'm not aware of a large shift away from judicial foreclosures at this time.
So to recap,
the changes that we saw in Senate Bill 558, it did close that judicial loophole. So now before filing a notice of default, which is the document that initiates a non-judicial foreclosure or filing a complaint in a judicial foreclosure, a lender, a non-exempt lender, so a larger lender, is required to offer their homeowner a resolution conference through the state's program. 558 simplified some of the notice requirements of the mediation program under 1552. It streamlined document exchange, and it did also add the opportunity for the Attorney General's office to enforce noncompliance. I'd like to say a few things about the implementation of 558. We did go through a temporary rulemaking process, but we held several advisory committee meetings. And the Attorney General's Advisory Committee is, we've made every effort to make it up of representative parties. And so it includes members from the lending industry, consumer advocates, mediation and facilitation stakeholders. And we've also included our contractor who administers the program. We saw some good activity from that group, including I'd just like to mention some of the work on outreach we've been doing, and Ms. Ryman has contributed quite a bit to that, going so far as to hold a homeowner focus group in which we asked people who had been involved with prior counseling agencies, what envelope are you more likely to open? What will give you some clues that this is, what will distinguish this from some of the less legitimate communications you might be getting? And how do we get the message to you that, that this is a state program and it's worth considering? So we've been putting some focus into outreach. We're continuing to look at how to reach people. What we've seen so far under 558, at DOJ, we expected it to take a while to start seeing lender requests. And actually, we've seen more than we expected. And the reason we expected it to take a while is that these are big industries that have to do a bit of work to change their practices. And so in the first 6 weeks, we've seen more requests from lenders for a resolution conference than we saw in the 13 months of 1552. And so that's encouraging. Whereas under 1552, over half of the requests were state entities, we are seeing private entities coming into the program. A few of the big, U.S. Bank, and we'll see this in the next slide, the big banks, Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, are still working on their processes. We think Chase is pretty close to, in batches, submitting somewhere in the range of 500 cases. We've heard from Wells Fargo that they have maybe somewhere in the range of 1,500 cases that are ready to be sent over while they work out the logistics. And Bank of America, we're not sure exactly where they are, but our contractor has been speaking with them. So we think that they're working on that. This is a breakdown of the requests we're seeing. And I think it, again, just illustrates that most of these are from the private sector. We see two large servicers, NationStar and GreenTree and U.S. Bank, that who participated in 1552, again, has been pretty proactive about participating in this program. The other piece of 558 is allowing homeowners to request a resolution conference. One difference is that whereas under 1552, generally a homeowner who self-identified as being at risk of foreclosure could request mediation, unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of response rate from we had almost no responses from the lenders, or I think it was about 83% non-response rate from the lenders. And we heard from the lending industry that there just wasn't enough definition around who could request mediation. We changed that. You changed that now a homeowner first sees a housing counselor who certifies whether they can qualify for a foreclosure avoidance measure. Those requests are trickling at this point, but we have seen a few, and it is a topic of discussion in our outreach committees. And it does make sense that they would be a little bit lower at this point because of the extra step of seeing a housing counselor. Finally, for my portion of the presentation, smaller lenders are exempt from the mediation requirement under the law. And if you'll remember, you lowered that requirement to 175 or fewer foreclosures in the prior year. And what we're seeing so far, not every lender has submitted an exemption who might be exempt, and they're not required to. Their lender is only required to submit an exemption at the time that they are ready to start foreclosing on properties. But what we're seeing is that most of these exempt lenders are doing very few foreclosures, less than 10, and only a few are really in those higher numbers. And with that, I'll turn it over to Emily Ryman.
Before you move on, Janet, I just want to make sure I understood. So in the first 6 weeks that this bill was applicable, you had 8 people request mediation, 8 in 6 weeks, and then prior to that, we were looking at it close to 30 a month. Is that about right?
That sounds about right, Chair Shields, members of the committee.
358 over 13 months, 30 and change. Okay.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman. I oversee the foreclosure counseling programs for NEDCO, which serves Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties. And before I get into the rest of my presentation, Chair Shields, just to add on to Ms. Bort's answer to the question, I believe the vast majority of those 300 and some grantors who tried to opt in to 1552 came right at the beginning of the original media campaign for that program, and that the number of people trying to opt into that program trickled down to I think sort of nil by the end of the year, 1552. So I'm hopeful that with outreach about the new program, we can see those numbers again with the grantors trying to opt in. I'm here to just talk a little bit about the state of foreclosure counseling on the ground and what we're seeing from the clients coming through our doors, also how we play into the new mediation program. In terms of counseling trends in 2013, just to hit a couple of the main highlights, we as counseling agencies have really put a lot of effort into adapting our services to the new environment of the judicial foreclosure landscape. After the NIDE decision and the switch largely from non-judicial to judicial, I think we actually got a little more concerned than we needed to that that would change how we do counseling and change how we provide services to clients. In the end, we discovered that with a little bit of extra training for our counselors, some stronger relationships with our attorney partners and legal aid particularly, and some new outreach methods, the switch to judicial foreclosure really hasn't changed foreclosure counseling much at all. We can still largely do the same work that we have always done with clients, and even the timelines have not shifted that drastically. So we've found that with the additional oversight provided by judges in the judicial process, that's really a system that we can work with and that we can help clients work with. The trick there is that counselors are not attorneys, and so we need to be very careful that we're not providing legal advice to clients. We've been very careful to retrain all of our counselors about that, and we've also created some really good partnerships with local private attorneys and with our legal aid attorneys around the state to be able to serve clients facing a judicial foreclosure in partnership with their attorney. We've also been seeing a little bit of a trend in the last year of servicer transfers happening, which is complicating our work with clients a little bit. It's not uncommon anymore for a client to begin working with us and have one servicer, and for either their loan or the servicing rights to be sold mid-process in trying to get a modification or trying to get a solution, which oftentimes is setting them back in their paperwork and setting back their timeline in trying to get to a solution. And also this year, we've had our first experiences with the mediation program. Under 1552, there were only 25 mediations, I believe, in the first year. 10 of those were at NEDCO. But we were really pleased with the outcome from those mediations. Of our 10, 5 reached a resolution right at the conference. And 2 of the 10 actually were able to resolve very shortly after the conference because of the process of having gone through mediation. And I would just add that for the 3 that didn't reach a resolution, the client still reported that that they were incredibly satisfied with being able to go through the process, and they found it very valuable. Just to give you an idea of the numbers that we're seeing, we interestingly are seeing a pretty big uptick right now in demand for counseling. These numbers are just from NEDCO, but I think that they are somewhat representative of what other counseling agencies are seeing as well. The uptick really started in June and July, so it was before the implementation of 558, and I think in a lot of respects can be attributed to all of the effort that was put into outreach in the last year. I think we're finally getting through to the populations that didn't know about us as a resource before, and we're starting to see them come through the door. So I am hopeful that that trend will continue, and as we begin to see clients in advance of the mediation program, those numbers will go up even more. And this is just to give you a little bit of a snapshot. These numbers represent the clients that we began working with in the first quarter of this year. So it's a little bit of a look at what we can help, the outcomes that we see with clients. A couple things I want to highlight. One is just that there was only a single foreclosure out of that batch thus far. So I think that speaks pretty well to the power of housing counseling and connecting homeowners with resources. The referral categories that you see, the referral to legal assistance, and then the referral to other, which largely represents the hardest hit funds programs and or short sale realtors, I think really speak to the network of services and tools that we now have as a state to try to assist homeowners who are in this situation. And then lastly, the one that I really want to highlight is that over a third of the cases we began working with in quarter one are still active and pending. And largely that third of the population is clients who really we think are eligible for a modification and are trying to get through the paperwork of getting a modification. So that is the number that I'm most interested in seeing a year from now when we have a fully functioning mediation program that most clients are able to access. I think that our timelines are going to come down and we're going to be able to help people reach a resolution much earlier in the process, so that 6 to 9 months after they're working with us, they're not still working with us, but they've actually reached a resolution through the mediation program. And I think that's all I have, so we can turn it over for questions.
Anything? Good. So you're basically arguing that we shouldn't be all that concerned about the fact that we only have 8 in 6 weeks because there's an additional step that people need to go through, which is the housing counselor.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I don't know. We don't know yet. I think it still is a bit early. We're talking about how, if, for instance, I think we saw quite a few homeowners are behind on their loans, and are we letting people who could benefit from this program know about the program and know about the changes? And we are working on that. I don't think we'll be stuck at 8 for too long, I hope.
Are there resources that you think could be useful from the legislature come February to help spread the word again? We haven't, this issue isn't getting the media attention that it was 2 years ago, so we might not have the earned media that we might get otherwise.
Yeah, Chair Shields, I'll take a stab, and I'm guessing Emily will have some perspective about this as well. I think because they're still settling into what does all the new system mean, I'd like to be able to come back in February and report to you about how the whole system is working, including the outreach piece and the other pieces, counseling, legal assistance, you know, how the whole system is working. And so I think that's an open question, with your indulgence, we'd certainly be happy to come back and have a conversation about how that's going and what we're seeing. But
I would echo that, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I think that we have a really good crew right now from OHCS, DOJ, counseling agencies, the service provider for mediation, working on how we can best use the resources that we have for outreach, make sure that our message is consistent and out in the community as much as possible. We weren't able to do that last year simply because the grantor ability to opt into 1552, we just didn't see any kind of a response to. So that outreach campaign is just now getting up up and going, and I think it will be effective once it gets off the ground. I would also just add the perspective that I think for most of us, the grantor-initiated cases, while it's a great feature, and we definitely don't want to make homeowners wait until their lender starts the process to access mediation, that was always meant to be a secondary population to the beneficiary-initiated cases. And I would echo Ms. Borth's comments that among the counseling community, we didn't expect to see beneficiaries initiating cases this early or this many cases. We expected there would be a several-month lag. I think if you look at the Washington State numbers, they saw something like 1,500 in the first year combined. So I would just emphasize that the beneficiary-initiated numbers are looking great, and I think higher than we expected, sooner than we expected.
Janet, do you have a theory of why, after the Supreme Court decision in NIDE, it would seem to me that the lenders got a pretty decisive win there, and saying that they, the Supreme Court saying that, you know, you can proceed in outside of court, and you don't have to record all the assignments in order to foreclose. That's my understanding of the decision, but yet they're still, the lenders are still going the foreclosure route, and I'm just curious why that might be.
And Chair Shields, members of the committee, while I can't speak for the lenders, what I've heard is that from some is that the decision may not have provided quite the level of certainty that some banks were looking for, but I think that question might be more fairly answered by a member of the lending industry.
Okay. Well, we'll give them a crack at it in November. But we at least want to get the overview from you all, and if you can invite the Oregon Bankers Association to be on our agenda next time, I'd appreciate that. Good. Any other questions? All right. Well, I know that this has been a turbulent time for all of you, and I really do appreciate your work on behalf of our constituents in all of Oregon. Thanks. All right. Next up, we're going to have an overview of the auditing process. Part of what our charge here is to do oversight work on the various branches of government, so we thought it would be useful to have Gary Blackmer from the Secretary of State's Audit Division come in and just give us a brief overview about how they make their decisions on who to audit and how to proceed. So, Gary, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk about audits, how we do them, and our strategies for what we select. I guess I would like to start by saying that the selection process for us is the most critical decision we make. There's a huge number of state agencies and state programs out there, and what we choose to look at a lot of times produces, you know, the best results if we do that well. But in order to choose those, we do start with the framework that the legislature sets, in the sense that members of the legislature collectively produce the expectations and allocate the resources to the agencies in order to accomplish their intent. And what we find is that those agencies don't always have a clear path from what they're trying to do to what the legislature wants them to accomplish. And our, I guess a simple way to describe what our audits do is clear some of the tangle between what they're doing and what they need to do and be able to get them to accomplish more. So that's one simple way to kind of describe what we do with audits. And going into some of the methodology that we use, we look at various strategies for getting there better. We're looking at various alternatives in terms of service delivery, looking at best practices around the country, looking how they can make their services more consistent and improve the quality. We're looking for ways that they can coordinate, collaborate with other agencies, even with other levels of government. We're looking at counties a lot more because they are a key extension of state government in many services, and trying to figure out ways that we can build better connections between state and local government. We're looking for inefficiencies, ways that they can save money, ways that they can improve timeliness of services, and we're also looking for risks out there that they may may not recognize that threaten the state's assets or threaten failure and services entirely. So if we do our work well, we're actually helping those agencies accomplish their mission objectives and ultimately what the legislature wants of them. But at the same time, we face our own tangle of challenges between what we'd like to accomplish in that audit and how we can get there. And we need to take those things into account as well as we go forward. But let me start with, I think, one of the biggest changes that we've made in the last few years, which is we've started looking at the mission of the agency and the frontline workers in the sense that if you think about where those services are delivered, it's oftentimes the frontline workers. And we spend time observing, interviewing, engaging with them to understand the challenges they face, because a lot of times if we can make a change at that front line, it has a huge impact on every Oregonian. So rather than looking at the back office things, we would prefer to look in those areas where there's a bigger impact. That it may be that it's the most important thing for that agency to look at their procurement practices or their payroll practices at that time, but if we're really looking at creating the greatest benefit from our audit dollars, looking at the agency's mission and what it's intending to accomplish is kind of the first place we go. So, you know, that's kind of rule one, which is to start where the money is and or where the risks are. We don't want to overlook dangerous situations where Oregonians are at risk because the state isn't providing adequate care. So not everything is dollars, but we do start with, again, that biggest impact across the Oregonians. So with that in mind, if we start with that, then we're looking at, okay, so what do we do once we've picked, say, an agency that we're going to look at? How do we get in there and figure out what we're going to audit within that agency? And we have something we call a survey, where we scan the agency, looking at all their programs, looking at places where we think we could make a difference with an audit. Where at the same time we're looking at the agency, we're reading the literature, trying to understand best practices. We're looking at performance measures they may have, looking at how they compare with other programs in other states, looking at any kind of cost information. And essentially, we're trying to get a sense of where we think other agencies like them are relative to where Oregon is. And if we see a big gap, that makes it a very good potential for doing an audit. And we start narrowing down our scope, and we start looking at what are the kinds of things we would need in order to satisfy our government audit standards. Our standards require that all of our audits are supported by objective evidence. So we're gathering work papers and documentation. We're putting down our analysis and explaining how we did it. And we're actually trying to build fact-based support for every statement in that audit report. That limits us quite a bit. If we just got to issue our opinions, we could do an audit in no time, but it would not necessarily have the credibility with the agency or the public that just going in and doing it that way, as opposed to building up the evidence and being able to show an agency, here's what it's costing you relative to other agencies. So that data part is important, and sometimes the data simply isn't there. We look at their management information systems. They may not be gathering the key pieces of information. They may not be gathering them consistently or accurately. So we may have to simply back up from an area like that. We may issue an audit and say, you need to gather better data in order to better manage the timeliness of your services. But oftentimes, there are other areas, other programs that we see that we can audit that does have good data. So to the degree that we start using data as one of the key things we're looking for, it can also be one of the biggest tangles that we run into. We may run into extremely complex areas where technical judgments are involved. I don't know that we could ever audit an engineer designing a bridge and be able to second-guess them unless we hired a smarter and better engineer. So there are areas that are very difficult for auditors to get into. Similarly, organizational structure can be very difficult. How people are organized to perform their tasks can be done in many different ways. we don't pretend that we have the right answer. If there is a right answer, we'd love to point agencies to it, but many times when we talk to other states, we find that each of them approach challenges in their own unique way. We may simply not find a better way to do things. Occasionally, we find an agency that's doing a pretty good job. We report on that. It doesn't always get reporters interested in it. They've told me that they don't report when the planes land on time either, but I think it's an important message that the public should hear. So we oftentimes do issue a report that has, you know, kind of a general conclusion on the quality of services. Let me take a little side note here to say we did, I think, a very technically challenging and important audit on the juvenile justice system, and we looked at the decisions that were made on whether they went to state custody or not, and there was a lot of concern that some counties with less resources were sending more youth to closed custody than other counties. We looked at 3,300 decisions and basically found that there was no disparity from one county to the next. From my standpoint, that was great, important information because it said the system is operating as it's intended, that there's equity and justice going on among these youthful offenders. It didn't get any coverage at all, but from my standpoint, I feel more comfortable knowing that we did do that intensive analysis and we did come to an important conclusion about the justice system. There are other contextual issues that make it very difficult for us to do an audit. For example, if there's ongoing litigation, we may find that a lot of people are being advised by attorneys not to provide any information to auditors, and our government audit standards even recognize that that can be a basis for withdrawing from an audit. We find that major reorganizations are underway, that a new agency director has come in and is making major changes in the way that the organization operates. In contrast, a new agency director may come in and ask us to do a complete, thorough look through the organization and make some recommendations on changes. And I guess that's one of the other ironies of auditing. It's a little bit of history. We take the past, we try to figure out what we could have done better based upon the past and reflect it into the future, and that's one of the key ways that we can make our audit recommendations very useful. And again, that's relying upon past data, and especially if they're doing the same thing in a consistent manner. If it's a lot of decisions that are one-off, so to speak, it's very difficult to kind of recommend changes when each decision is unique. So, and there's other issues, contextual, like timing. I mentioned new directors, but there's also other ones where we want to focus on, like state general funds or another key area where, given the tightness of those dollars, if we have a choice between looking at federal funds or state funds and their equal amounts, we would look at the state general funds. We have limited staff resources, but we also have limited expertise in that we may have one person in our office who's very good at GIS, but they're completely busy with another audit. We might change the timing of the audit so that audit comes when the person is free from the other. So timing is one of the aspects there. But I also want to emphasize that we do try to tap into the legislature and the interests, and we've done a number of audits. We're embarking on one, or we're underway on TriMet, for example, which was of great interest in the most recent session. And it is, for us, if the legislature has a strong interest in it, we really want to be able to satisfy that need, because if we can help make better decisions, that's something that we will do. I guess, you know, one of the things in the back of our mind always is, and I've said this to our Ways and Means Committee, there's so many audits and so little time, that if we see three or four audits in front of us and one of them is more difficult to do than the others, we've got plenty more besides those three or four that we can take on. There are, from my standpoint, many, many audits, hundreds of audits that could be done, and it's a matter of putting the ones that are the most important in front. And we have taken on, I think, some very challenging topics. If you compare the kinds of topics that we have taken on relative to audit shops in any other state, I think you'll find that we have a very kind of expansive and aggressive scope and objective that we set forth in our audits. So with that, let me just kind of walk through a couple of audits just as an example of what we do. I've only got three or four here. We just issued an audit on increasing the number of adults with GEDs. We found in thinking about the 40-40-20 plan that the state has adopted that there are 11% of Oregonians, or 340,000, who have no high school degree or GED. We made recommendations on how there could be better connections between the high schools and the community colleges, the community colleges being the ones that help students prepare for those exams. That audit actually came out of an earlier audit that we did on community colleges and workforce development, where we saw a disconnect between the programs that the community colleges were providing and what the employment department was forecasting for future labor needs. So we actually, in this survey, came up with two topics that, from the standpoint of ease of stepping into the second one, was much lower risk. I think every audit we do is a gamble. We're putting out a lot of audit hours with a gamble that we're going to return something of value. And we want to be as sure of winning that bet as we can. And so these were two that we felt really comfortable about. We looked at Health and Human Services caseload forecasting and ways to increase confidence for the legislature. There are some concerns that Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority were essentially saying what their budget would be, and it was kind of a black box from the legislator's standpoint. We looked into it, and we found it was a very good forecasting method. We found one area where it could be improved around independence, and we made some recommendations for greater transparency in the decisions and documenting the techniques involved. And so to that extent, we think because of the billions of dollars that are affected by that forecast, that it helped the legislature in terms of its confidence in decision-making. We looked at the cost of a college degree. It's a large, critical issue for the public and the youth that are trying to get into college and afford to pay for it. And we didn't look at financing and matters like that so much as costs. Where is the money going to get a college degree? And we made a number of recommendations around what the colleges needed to do to contain costs, but also to better inform students about what would happen in their prospects. So that audit, it was essentially two or three audits in one because we covered so many different areas. And lastly, we actually did one on housing services for Director Van Vliet. She was tasked with the responsibility of coming up with a way to look at her organization and come up with a sustainable level of services. We applied a methodology the General Government Accountability Office uses around duplication, overlap, and fragmentation, and identified for the 49 programs in her area, there were some of that going on, but we also looked at 75 programs in other agencies to see where the overlap was in terms of nutrition, housing, energy, and so forth. So we provided a large matrix of all the things that she could look at and consider where she could partner with those agencies, where there might be sufficient services already she could withdraw. So that's kind of a quick overview of what we do, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Lori?
Well, I appreciate the information, and I thank you so much for coming. I have no question.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Now we're going to move on to the next agenda item, and it's summary of research on the Lawful Trade Practices Act in other states. And Chana, why don't you just go ahead and take it away.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, as you recall, we had House Bill 3160 in our committee this last year, which dealt with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, or the UTPA. After session ended, you asked me to research other states' UTPA equivalents, and you also looked specifically at two different cases. And the question with the cases was, do these states' statutes allow these claims against insurers, and is that what produced the result in these cases? So to start with, I did a high-level overview of the 50 states. My methodology, I reviewed the state statutes. I looked at some case law when necessary if the statute wasn't clear. I did not talk to any practitioners in those states. I did not call the commission's office. I did not find out what actually happened. This is just what's on the books. So it's not scientific. There may be some disagreement about a few of these things. I used a little bit of discretion in my categorization, whether something went into the mixed category or the no category, or the mixed category or the yes category, could be open to interpretation. So very briefly, the UTPA statutes fell into four categories: yes, mixed, no, and unsure. Unsure is if the statute doesn't specify and there's no case law. There were eight unsures in my list. On the no's, there were 20 states that excluded specifically or by case law insurance from their statutes, or they had such narrow exceptions that the claims were difficult to bring. Mixed would be situations such as Tennessee, where their Consumer Protection Act exempts any conduct that is specifically authorized by the insurance commissioner. But what the courts have said is that means consumers can't regulate. They can't say, insurance commissioner, you need to do this. I'm taking your authority away. California is a similar structure, but California is interpreted broadly, so it's put into the S category. So we had 8 in the mixed category, 15 in the yes category. So using that, we looked at Connecticut and California. And the Connecticut case was called Artie's Auto Body versus the Hartford Fire Insurance Company. And a little bit of background there, the Hartford was accused of sending claimants to specific auto body shops and then manipulating the hour and wage laws in those particular shops in such a way that it drove down the return rates for those auto body shops. A jury returned a $14.7 million verdict and $20 million punitive damages on top of that. And because insurance is allowed under Connecticut's Unfair Trade Practices Act, that stood in court. And it's under appeal to the Supreme Court right now. California is People v. WellPoint, Inc. And in that case, there was a $6 million settlement. Blue Cross, Anthem Blue Cross of California, was accused of systematically using post-claim underwriting to identify and cancel particular policies. Up to 6,000 policies were canceled. They were canceled when policyholders brought claims for things like cancer treatment. And then the allegation is that they would go back and look and see, is there a discrepancy that we can use to cancel the policy? California said, yes, this is a claim that can be brought under its UCL statute.
UCL.
Let's see. What does UCL stand for? Unfair competition law. And $6 million settlement. I'm not sure if that one is being challenged in the court right now.
And so what you're saying in Connecticut and California are, yes, UTPA, insurance is under the UTPA and allow these cases to proceed. Okay. So there were 20 states that are in the no category, you said?
Correct.
Oregon is one of those, right?
Yes. This does include Washington, D.C.
Okay. Good. And Shannon, can you tell us a little bit about your background so that everybody knows?
Certainly, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I am a 2010 graduate of the University of Oregon School of Law and passed the bar in 2010. I've been here since 2011.
Questions, panel? All right. Thank you, Chan. I appreciate you rolling up your sleeves and doing the work on that. Let's move on. Actually, why don't we go to the, now that we have a quorum, we'll jump into adoption of committee rules. Do I need to open the organizational meeting? Okay, so I will close the subcommittee of the Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection and open an organizational meeting and let the record show that we have a quorum, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Bairdsugar, and myself. Senator Mona Sanderson.
I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17, 2013.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17, 2013. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. That being said, why don't we move on to our next...
You want to close the organizational meeting?
I will close the organizational meeting. Thank you, Janet.
Do you want to stand at ease while I dial?
Yes, and we will stand at ease while you dial.
All right.
Is this for Joel? So where is it? What's this?
Well, he was the insurance commissioner in Pennsylvania. Hello, Mr. Aereo. This is Chip Shields, the chair of the oddly titled General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, hi, Senator. How are you doing?
Good, good. Some of you who've been around for a while might recall that Joel was the insurance division administrator in 2005 when I started my freshman year. And are we going to begin with him, or are we going to begin with Dr. Goldberg? Okay, good. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Goldberg.
Pleasure to be here. Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to kick things off, just provide, I think, some context to the work that's going on and why we're here today. I think that you've got the letter from the governor that the governor wrote to the Health Policy Board, and that's really the context for a lot of work that's going on now at the Health Policy Board in conjunction with Laura Calley and the Insurance Division and with the board. And but what the governor has asked is, one, he's really recognized that we're at a pretty momentous time. Certainly, in terms of healthcare, we're seeing some of the biggest healthcare changes in our state and our nation in the past 50 years since the beginning of Medicare and Medicaid. And I think as we have done all the work in the state over the last couple of years around the CCOs and looking at how we better contain costs and improve healthcare quality, and at the same time, we have all that's happening with the Affordable Care Act. Many people coming into coverage, both in the Medicaid plan as well as in commercial health plans. What the governor asks is that we really take a look at how we align the work that's happened over the last couple of years to get better health, better care, lower costs, how we align all of those reform efforts with what's happening with the Affordable Care Act, with what's happening in Medicaid, with what's happening in the insurance exchange, and how we can coordinate that more. And he specifically asked us to look at a few things. One was, how do we align the care model that we currently have developed within our CCOs within PEB and OEB, as well as within Cover Oregon? And where that work is going on, we actually have 6 board members, 2 Cover Oregon board members, 2 PEB, and actually 8, 2 Cover Oregon board members, 2 PEB board members, 2 OEB board members, and 2 Health Policy board members meeting to really look at how we can better align this care model that we've developed with these other lines of business, so to speak. That work has begun. Governor also looked for us to provide some information on strategies to mitigate cost shifting. We anticipate somewhere between 200,000, 300,000, maybe 400,000 people coming into coverage in this state over the next year. What will and can that do so that we can be certain we mitigate cost shifts, we help to decrease health insurance premiums, and increase overall transparency and accountability? We're beginning to work on some of those ideas with the Health Policy Board. And then the last piece of that, and I think the discussion of much of today, is what opportunities are there to look at Oregon's insurance rate review process and how can that help contribute to all of this work. In other words, we're looking at all the levers we have and fully plan on coming back with recommendations around all of them. Around the rate review process, what we've done is we've asked Joel Ario, who Senator Shields indicated was a past insurance commissioner here, has had a lot of experience in Washington, D.C., in helping bring up the Affordable Care Act, and has really got a great background in history, understands national health care issues, he understands state health care issues, and he understands insurance and rate review. And so we've asked for him and his group to really come in as some consultants to the Health Policy Board, to the state, to the Insurance Division, and help to lay out what are the possibilities in terms of how and what we could further do around rate review. He made a presentation to the board last month. This past month, we had another former insurance commissioner, Chris Kohler from Rhode Island, come and present some thoughts about his experience and what levers and could be used to help us get at our goals. And Joel's here today. He'll talk to you in many ways about some of the same things he laid forth for the board. What's possible? And as he'll go through all of the, as you well know, as legislators, anything that we do from a policy perspective has both pros and cons, and you've got to balance that out, and that's what he'll go through. The board has not made any final decisions yet, and Laura will talk to you. We've been working very closely with the insurance division, and I don't think that Laura's come to any final conclusions yet either. I think what we're trying to figure out is what's the right path. What are the best things to do? What things may require statutory change? And if there is, and there are some recommendations, we'd come forward with those. What things could potentially be done without statutory change? And just what do we want to do given this new healthcare environment? So that's really the context. I'm going to turn things over to Laura to talk about her participation in this, and then we'll hear from Joel.
Thanks, Dr. Goldberg, Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Insurance Division of DCBS. And just keying off of what Dr. Goldberg was saying about the aspects of the policy board work that may affect rate review, the Insurance Division is involved to the extent that we're providing support to OHA and to the board of helping them understand the current state of rate review, the extent of the current statutory authority that the Insurance Division does have, and help that board think through how some of the options that are on the table, some of the options that you're going to hear Joel discuss shortly, how they might work, where, actually helping explore whether some of these things do require statutory change or if we have the ability to accomplish some of them through the regulatory process, through rulemaking, and also providing subject matter expertise about kind of the level of detail that we already look at things, what kind of information would be useful, where can we kind of partner with information that that OHA is capturing to leverage that in the rate review process. So while we're not really driving the process forward, we very much are a big part of that that consultative process with OHA in providing the best information possible to the board so that they can make good recommendations. And again, as Dr. Goldberg had said, really the intent of this process is not for the insurance division to arrive at a conclusion, but to help the policy board look broadly across the system what really should we be doing to accomplish the goals of keeping medical costs down while holding up quality of care, and what can we do specifically through rate review that can help that? So I'd say with that, if there are no questions at this point, maybe we can turn it over to Joel and he can take you through it.
Welcome, Joel.
Good to be here, Chair Shields. It's been great to reacquaint myself with some of the Oregon health policy issues. One of the pleasant surprises is that you've made much progress with the rate review process since I was there. I remember our conversations back in 2007, and I'm very pleased to see the statutes today have taken a number of additional provisions with them to really enhance that process. So I commend you for your work on this issue over the last 6 years. What I'm going to do here for about 10 minutes is just walk through the presentation in summary form that I made to the policy board back in August. I think everybody has the deck that I presented. Is that right?
Yes.
And, okay. And Joel, we've got
so
your
I actually had the
up.
Easy part of this assignment, which is, as Dr. Goldberg said, to really come up with the range of options for the committee. So it's kind of the brainstorming part of this, if you will, and then to help the board think through these different options, evaluate them. But at the end of the day, the policy board will have to decide which of the options make the most sense, and then to the extent there's legislative implications, that will come back to the legislature to actually make final decisions on some of these issues. But the starting point is really slide three there. Dr. Goldberg already made reference to the governor's charge, and it really was to align ACA implementation is the key phrase, I think, in the governor's letter with the CCO reform. So bring the commercial marketplace along with the Medicaid marketplace. And then Dr. Kitzhaber, of course, had some specific ideas here. So there are four of them. There are mitigate cost shifting, decrease health insurance premiums, increase transparency and accountability, and enhance the rate review process. And so those are kind of the guiding lights for developing the list of the possible options that the board could consider here, and all of it within the triple aim, which I'm sure all of you are very familiar with, and I won't have to dwell on here. If we move to the next slide, Dr. Goldberg again has talked about the timeline I presented in August. Commissioner Kohler from Rhode Island presented in September. I will make a brief comment here. After the first presentation that I made, there was some notion that we were maybe taking too much to heart about the so-called Rhode Island model. And so I think Commissioner Kohler made it clear that the Rhode Island model is not really what's being offered up to Oregon. It's some of the process that Rhode Island went through and some of the lessons they learned about how to proceed on these issues. But everybody recognized, I think, from the beginning that Oregon would have its own unique solutions, and certainly they would probably not be exactly the same kind of solutions that a much different state like Rhode Island had adopted.
Joel, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
So I was interested in that he was presenting. If you had to come up with three ways that he thought rate review could be improved generally, maybe not for Oregon, but what three ways was he suggesting were very important?
Well, I think his first suggestion was you really have to work with stakeholders carefully. You have to cast a broad net. You have to listen to everybody. You have to have a process that's inclusive in order to get the kind of buy-in that you need to succeed on a project like this. The second thing I think he'd say is that you need to be specific when you do settle on some broad strategies that seem to have broad support. That's only the beginning, and then you need to really drill down into the details of those strategies and make sure you've got something that's measurable to so that there can be some accountability in whatever measures are chosen to move things forward. And then I think the third thing he'd say, you'll see these are all process things because that's really what Chris was emphasizing, is you need to be flexible because, for instance, in Rhode Island's case, two of the four specific metrics that they started with didn't prove to be the most successful for them, so they adapted and changed. They kept the same broad strategies, but they changed their metric on how to deal with, for instance, provider pricing issues that they were looking at. They changed the way they looked at the details there. So those were the three broad lessons that I think he would say are most important.
What do you think is most promising from the Rhode Island, the way their processes work? What do you think Oregon should be looking at most closely to adopt from them?
Chair Shields, that's a good question. One of the hard parts of this job for me has been learning that I'm no longer in charge of things. I'm a consultant now, and so I make proposals, make suggestions, but I don't actually get to decide anymore what's the best idea. And so I've rigorously avoided trying to answer questions like that. I can provide information to the board. We could talk some here about, as we get into the details here, maybe about some of the ideas that got more discussion at that meeting, but that I really have to keep on my side of the equation here, which is to make suggestions, to offer ways of thinking about the issues, but not to be kind of, you know, so-called picking the winners and the losers.
Okay, let me then ask, did Commissioner Kohler talk about how they're encouraging investments in primary care? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, the primary care topic was on the table, and it was on the table in a significant way at the first meeting as well.
So what?
Not only just primary care in general, which was a focus in Rhode Island, and I know it's of great interest to Oregonians as well. It's also, you know, particular models for primary care that have been discussed, including the Oregon version of primary care medical home. I'm going to get that acronym wrong, but it's the model that's used in the CCO. So both the general principle and the specific have been discussed, yes.
Dr. Goldberg, were you at the presentation? Can you expand on what Rhode Island's doing on primary care?
Yeah, well, sure. Chair Shields, members of the committee, what Rhode Island has done, my understanding, I think Laura and Joel probably know a little better, is they've really looked at being certain that a certain percent of premium goes to primary care. What I would say, based on the discussions at at the board meeting, is that apropos of Joel's comments, that I think that one of the things that Chris Kohler talked about was that a lot of successful healthcare systems make strong investments in primary care. I think that resonated a lot with the board. I think there's been actually a lot of discussion about how do we have there be more of an emphasis on primary care. We've done a lot of work in this state on patient-centered primary care homes. There's been some enhanced funding to that through the feds. And I think what the board is going to be wrestling with over the next couple of months is, okay, knowing all of that and seeing what's happened in Rhode Island, now it really gets at what Joel was talking about. What's now the specific lever to pull around that? What is it that we want to see beyond just saying, gee, we would love to see there be more primary care, but is rate review the best process to do that? Are there some other mechanisms to do that? I think that's really going to be the discussion, but I think the board was impressed with the focus on primary care, and I think that's something they're going to look at. And the other was around some of the issues around transparency. I don't know if Laura, you want to...
If you could address how they incent primary care, that would be great.
Sure, Chair Shields, that's actually where I was going to try to elaborate a little bit. So, and hopefully I remember this correctly, I don't have Commissioner Kohler's slides directly in front of me, but what I recall is that they had embarked on this process of actually trying to measure the percentage of health care dollars that were going toward primary care and looking kind of at how that tracked over time. And I think that they found that kind of a useful thing to understand, but I think some of the unanswered questions that they either had at the time, I don't know if they still have, because I don't kind of know exactly where they are in terms of possibly making changes or adjustments to that, but there was a concern that it may not necessarily be resulting in an overall reduction in the rate of medical cost trend. So the question was, are we actually seeing better quality as a result of this incentivization to spend more on primary care? Is there another metric we need to be capturing to help us understand whether there's improvement, and are we incentivizing it in the right way so that we're actually seeing some benefit to the cost trend? So I think that was kind of the debrief, lessons learned from Commissioner Kohler's presentation. But I think there was a lot of discussion around the board of maybe we should be moving towards setting a baseline of collecting some information about what's happening now in terms of proportion of medical dollars being spent on preventive care, on primary care. How can we see that track over time? Are there some kind of best practices that we can drive toward?
Okay. And so they included that primary care as percentage of overall premium in the rate review process?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, I believe so, but I would have to go back and double check. But there certainly were some metrics around the primary care spend.
Okay. All right.
And we'll be happy to also get you his presentation to the board. And actually on the board website, you can watch it as well.
Great. And specifically, if maybe Commissioner, since he's kind of a colleague of yours, if you can get us a response on, you know, how they actually incent primary care. Is it through the rate review process?
Absolutely.
I think that's a pretty interesting idea.
I actually believe that is addressed in the slides, but if it isn't addressed in enough detail, I'll be sure to follow up with him. Thank you.
Chair?
Senator Mark,
I just have a question. It was brought to my attention from your website, Health Insurance in Oregon. Well, actually, the source is the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. When we're just comparing, well, first of all, I want to ask, when did Rhode Island start using a percentage of premium going to primary care? What year?
Chair Shield, Senator Monis Anderson,
has it been a while?
I do not know at this point, so I'd have to go back and double check. I don't know if Joel knows the answer to that.
Joel?
I believe about 4 years ago. I think they have 4 years of data now on their goal of having each of the primary care, insurers increase their primary care spend by 1% a year. That's kind of the core metric. And then they had a second metric related to supporting either the state's chronic care program, which is a form of medical home in Rhode Island, or supporting their own form of medical home. So
okay,
those are the two metrics, and I think they're in the fourth or fifth year now, the program.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the annual premiums by state small group market, and it does list Rhode Island as being an average of $300 more. I assume this is per year. For an individual single employee, and then about 1,800 more in Rhode Island for family coverage. Compare, 14,800 to Oregon's 13,000. So, I think there's a whole lot of factors too, because evidently we're lower than Rhode Island is right now. Just observation. Thank you.
All right. Joel, would you like to continue?
Sure. So the rest of that slide, we had the presentation by Commissioner Kohler. He did, to address a little bit that last question, talk about the fact that Rhode Island is a small state and doesn't have more than a couple major insurers, and so that puts them at some disadvantage against a state like Oregon. It's bigger and has a more competitive market already. So some of those dynamics, I think, are distinctions between the two states and why people do properly distinguish them and why maybe there's somewhat different pricing and results in the states as starting points. On October 1st, the next meeting, the goal is to actually have some specific proposals to put in front of the committee. So there are a number of meetings which Dr. Goldberg and Commissioner Kelly can speak to going on this month to set up a more specific discussion at that October 1st meeting. And then depending on the results of that meeting, either those proposals or potentially some others would come back in November as final recommendations. And the goal really is to move this to final decisions at the policy board on November 6th, so that to the extent there were any proposals that required legislative action, there would be time to translate those into legislative proposals by the December filing date. So moving ahead, we talked a little bit that day about guiding principles. They're not anything probably surprising to anybody on the committee there. Enhanced transparency across the health system, have clear metrics and public reporting so that there's accountability, focus on outcomes rather than overly prescriptive regulation, and leave as much flexibility to the market as is consistent with the regulatory goals. And then finally, this last one, which Commissioner Kelly would be more expert to talk to you about in Oregon right now, but we've got a rate review process that should be actuarially based and still is actuarially based, but also now wants to hold carriers accountable for quality improvement and cost containment, and holding those two principles together creates some tensions, but they're both important parts of the system in Oregon today. We then talked about the Rhode Island model, which I think I covered in answer to one of your questions, Chair Shields. You got that, and over on the right hand there, the lessons: get buy-in up front, develop measurable standards, and remain flexible and adapt. That's certainly the lessons that have come back several times in the discussions that I've been part of in Oregon. And then we kind of get into the meat of it here with three slides that go through the different options that this is the brainstorming part, what's on the table as potential options in transparency, then in cost containment, then in quality improvement. You see on the left-hand side of the transparency side, Oregon is, and I'm not blowing smoke here, but it really is a national leader, I think, in rate transparency, pretty widely recognized for the work. Again, my commendation to Chair Shields for much of that, but it certainly has been a leading state. It's got an annual report, moving forward on an all-claims, all-payers database. So there's a strong platform, and we talked that day about different ways to expand that kind of transparency. There could be more public reporting. There could be enhanced pricing disclosure. There could be something about provider spending trends. There could be more consumer-friendly tools. Chair Shields, you asked about which of these has gotten significant discussion. That last one is one that seems to get a lot of attention in each of the discussions as the process moves forward. I believe there's legislation on this, that it's one thing to have all this information out there. It may be another thing to have it out there in the form that consumers actually can understand. And so moving forward on that, the notion of making the information more consumer-friendly, packaging it better, is an issue that's gotten some real discussion. Moving to the quality improvement slide, again, there are a number of standards in the CCO side of the equation already. In Oregon, there are a number of ACA requirements there on the left-hand side, and again, changes in quality improvement is one of the things that's called out as a consideration currently under the rate review statute. So different ways to enhance that accountability, could set minimum standards for certain things. Some of these things already have minimum standards, like never events. You could set goals at the state or carrier level where there aren't clear metrics now. You can require the use and spread of best practices, and then you can use payment reform options. There's certainly a lively set of different kind of payment reform options, moving away from fee-for-service out there and pay-for-performance, bundle payments, use those to incent better quality. So those are some of the kinds of issues that were discussed. And then finally, under cost containment, again, that is a standard in the current Oregon statute as a consideration in the rate review process. What has the carrier done to improve its cost containment efforts? There's been an indexing system developed on the administrative costs so that it becomes easier to compare across carriers the way in which they're containing costs in the administrative side, potentially a model for other parts of rate filings. And then there's on the right-hand side there a discussion of some of the potential enhancements. You could expand the administrative costs to deal with medical trend, and you could deal with limited or select networks as a strategy to create strong pricing options for the consumer, promote value-based product designs, wellness incentives. Many of these things, like IT initiatives, are already underway, as the committee well knows, and other aspects of the Oregon reform efforts. There's the question of if we actually are increasing the number of people who have insurance coverage, reducing the uninsured, then that should reduce the uncompensated care, particularly at the hospital level. That kind of mitigating of, should then mitigate cost shifting. And if it's true, as USA says, that there's $1,000 cost shift on the commercial premiums today because of the extra load for uncompensated care, that should contribute to a reduction in premium. So looking more carefully at charity care of bad debt issues and having some accountability around those issues, that was a discussion. And then that really dense bullet towards the bottom, there was a lot of discussion of too. We've already, Chair Shields, you've been already probing on this, the adopting patient-centered primary care, care home models, and mandating or encouraging stronger support for those, encouraging support for other kinds of health care delivery system reforms, and then also outcome-focused payment reforms. All of that is, of course, part of the CCO model and the discussion of then how much of that is transferable to the commercial marketplace and how might it have to be adapted to be made applicable in the commercial marketplace. All of that was part of the discussion as well. That last example, again, was one that I was asked to include because it was something I dealt with when I was the Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner, limiting rate increases where there's excess surplus. That so far has not gotten a lot of discussion in Oregon, but it's this illustrates that it really was a broad brainstorm. So that's kind of the issues, the next steps that we've sort of basically talked about already, draft recommendations and have straw models ready for the October board meeting and try to have final recommendations by the November board meeting. So that in a nutshell is how we launched back in August, and we've already gotten into many of the details here, and I'm happy to answer more questions, as I'm sure Lisa and Laura are too.
Note takers immediately. Joel, could you tell us a little bit more about the Pennsylvania model and excess surplus, what you did there?
Yeah, it comes out of a 2005 discussion with, it was actually not market-wide, but applicable to the four Blues plans. So unlike Oregon, with one, the basic Blue plan, Blue-branded plan anyway, there are four Blues in Pennsylvania, and there were issues about their kind of community responsibilities. And evolving out of those discussions was two things. One, a commitment from those four Blues to support the state's sort of Medicaid-type expansion. That's not quite what it was called, but it's essentially an expansion program above the Medicaid levels in Pennsylvania. The Blues supported that. And the second part of the agreement was to have accountability around surplus levels. So through a study done by Lewin, there were certain RBC markers that were set, dependent on the size of the Blue, exactly what they were, but, you know, in the neighborhood of 500 or 600% RBC, risk-based capital, the carrier could not take a profit load in a rate filing, and at another number, somewhere between 700 and 900% RBC, they could not get a rate increase. Since that was put into effect, none of the carriers have exceeded the top number and been blocked on rate increases. A couple times carriers have exceeded the middle number where they then can't take a profit load in their rate increases. So both numbers there, that just to give you a sense of reference, 200% RBC is where the regulator starts to get concerned and looks to require some repair work in order to avoid an insolvency. And so the numbers where these other things kick in are, you know, multiples above that baseline.
Thank you, Joel. Commissioner, do you know how Oregon's carriers compare in surplus? Are we at the 200% level, or are we significantly higher?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, so it varies by carrier, and I can get that information for you. It's actually part of the rate filings that are what's required that carriers state what their RBC, and you know, just and you may know this, but you know, RBC is basically their capital, their current capital as a percentage of this kind of baseline required capital to maintain basic solvency. And so it does range. It can be as low as kind of above that point that Joel mentioned, where we as regulators get concerned for the solvency of the company. There's some companies that have quite a lot of capital that have a much larger multiple and can be, you know, in the higher triple digits. But I can get you some precise information if you'd like some summarization of what the kind of the current status it would be as of year end 2012. We can get you that information, but it's quite variable.
Get it to the committee administrator.
Absolutely,
because I think that's I mean, basically we've got a lot of nonprofit insurance companies here in Oregon, and obviously the for-profit companies pay out in dividends and don't hold on to their capital. But so basically surplus is like profit to the nonprofit ones. Is that
Chair Shields, members of the committee? So that can be the case. It does, like you said, depend on kind of the for-profit status of the company. But, you know, as with any type of insurance. You know, health insurance isn't immune from various risks in terms of, you know, pricing risk, reserving risk. You know, basically, are companies estimating correctly what their future costs are going to be? And so surplus is also meant to deal with kind of unforeseen circumstances. It's a buffer to protect the solvency and, you know, therefore really protecting consumers' ability to receive payment for the claims that they were promised payment for under their policies. So that is a key factor of surplus, is to be there to protect the promises that insurance companies make to consumers.
And Joel, what I heard you saying is that the statute was very prescriptive in Pennsylvania, where here the insurance commissioner is allowed to, or the DCBS directors can consider these things, but they don't have to, and they don't have to provide a justification of how they took surplus into account. But yours was pretty prescriptive. Is that correct?
Yes. I think it's so prescriptive that Pennsylvania still remains the only state to have that kind of law. It is actually codified in law, so that kind of law. Michigan did something, I think, more by agreement this year, though it may have some legal aspects. But as Commissioner Kelly said, being a former insurance commissioner, when you start to play with those surplus levels, you do kind of make yourself nervous about what happens if there's a bad year kind of thing.
Okay. Good. Any other questions?
Yes, Joel, this is Lori Monis Anderson. Do you know how many carriers are in Rhode Island and how many carriers are in Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, it's the Blues are in all the different markets, and usually two of the Nationals are in most of the markets. Aetna's in like three of them. United's in a couple of the major markets in Pennsylvania, and well, actually, those are the two major ones. Coventry, I was going to say, but they're now part of Aetna. So there's usually a Blue plus at least one, maybe two national carriers in most markets. And then Pennsylvania also had UPMC, Pittsburgh Medical Center, and Geisinger as a couple of the kind of, you know, Kaiser-like integrated delivery systems that covered a couple parts of the state. So, you know, several carriers in most markets. Rhode Island, I think, has the Blue as the dominant carrier that has more than 50% of the market. United is second with, you know, a much smaller share, maybe 10 or 20%. And then they have one or two smaller kind of provider-based networks, one that's local and then one that came down from Massachusetts. So it's like most states of that size, the smaller states, the Blue plan tends to have a pretty dominant market share.
That's what I like about Oregon, that we have more of a competitive market. But
yeah, Senator, I remember when you and I went back and forth on some of those reforms in 2007, and we wanted to protect the competitiveness. And now, having served in Pennsylvania and then been involved at the national level through the exchanges and really wanting, you know, there to be competitive markets in as many states as possible, Oregon has a pretty good situation with, I think, six now, it used to be seven, carriers, all of whom have, you know, a significant, like, plus 5%, 5% or more, I think most of them even 10% or more, market shares. And that is relatively unique, except for the very biggest states like California and New York and Florida and Texas. Most of the states Oregon size don't have that many competitive carriers. And so it's something you do want to protect.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as I'm looking on Senator Monis Anderson's sheet, Oregon has the most competitive market according to a recent study, but yet our premiums are not the lowest.
Correct.
And so we still got room to move. In fact, Washington's premiums are lower in the small group market sheet that Senator Monis Anderson is referencing. So it's great to have a competitive market. That kind of cuts both ways, though, too, because the dynamic between hospitals and insurance companies is can be different than when there's only two carriers in a market.
Mm-hmm. You want to have competition at that provider level, too. That helps.
Yeah. Good. Any further questions? All right. Joel, are you going to be back in Oregon anytime soon?
I'm coming back for that November board meeting.
Okay.
At least. I may be there before that, but right now that's the next time I'm there.
Could you also schedule a phone conference with my office? I would like to have a further discussion.
Absolutely. Are you talking about sort of sometime soon or near that November date?
At least a couple of weeks before the November date, yeah.
Okay. I look forward to it.
Great. Okay. Any further questions? We are out of here on time.
Great. Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go to a bill.